Today is Monday, June 7th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. After more than 6 months of fighting in Ethiopia's Tigray region, do people see an end in sight?
Really, they don't. People are devastated and angry.
Plus, Pope Francis stopped short of apologizing for the deaths of 215 indigenous children at a former Catholic school.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said this week the Catholic Church must take responsibility for its role.
And a look back at the Normandy invasion 77 years ago. We'll have these stories and more next. For more than 6 months, fighting has engulfed Ethiopia's Tigray region. The United Nations warns of imminent famine, and there appears to be no end in sight for the conflict. VOA Middle East correspondent and Istanbul bureau chief Heather Murdoch is traveling in the region, and I caught up with her in the regional capital of Mekelle after a day of traveling through villages.
Officially, the Eritrean soldiers are supposedly going to be leaving the region, but they don't appear to be. I can't say, speak for the whole region, but at least in Addis Ababa, they don't appear to be leaving. What happened yesterday when we arrived in the early afternoon, the markets closed because, and lots of people told us this story that there was an Eritrean soldier in the market, and the local people, in their anger, started throwing rocks and killed the soldier. And then other Eritrean soldiers, as many as 100 or 200, came to the market to retrieve the body of the soldier and were threatening the local people with revenge for the death of their soldier. This is a great example of how people feel in this town. There's a lot of anger, a lot of mistrust. And when local people told that story, you could see them almost not even be able to speak. They were so angry, not about the fact that they're about the Eritrean presence in their city. There was also skirmishes in the area recently, and it's quite tense and very near to a serious battle zone. We also traveled to Housing today, which is one of the worst hit towns in this area, which has been taken over by various forces. I think about four or five times it's switched hands since last November.
Heather, did they say where their anger is directed? Because this is a war that is being carried out between the Tigray People's Liberation Front, Ethiopian and Eritrean forces, and all sides in the conflict have been accused of committing human rights abuses.
A lot of the anger is directed at the Ethiopian government forces and specifically the Eritrean forces. But one of the points of contention with the Ethiopian government forces, or at least the Ethiopian government, is that it allows Eritrean forces to be in their country. They see the Eritrean forces as threatening, and there's lots of stories of abuses. And while the stories about the Ethiopian government forces, there's also terrible stories about them, and as well as every other group involved in this battle. But on the ground, what we hear every day is anger directed towards the Eritrean forces and blaming the Ethiopian forces for allowing them to be there.
Heather, in your conversations with the people that you're meeting in Tigray, do they have a sense of what the future holds for them? Because this is a conflict that has been raging for over 6 months. Do they see an end in sight?
Really, they don't. People are devastated and angry. One thing I've been so surprised at is how many people speak so frankly to us and are happy to go on camera to say things that are very sensitive and potentially dangerous for them. And we try to mitigate that danger as much as possible, but the people don't ask for it. And they say, what am I to be afraid of? This war is going to continue. What could possibly happen to me is worse than what's already happened. This region has been at war for decades off and on, and for longer than that, for as long as anyone can remember, there's been conflicts. So people are afraid that this war will continue. There is, of course, people talking about dialogue, but so far both sides have very stark positions, and there's not been a idea presented that is somewhere in between the goals of each side. So while there are people trying to talk about peace talks and dialogue, solid ideas for how to make that happen have not been presented publicly yet.
Heather Murdoch is VOA's Middle East correspondent, as well as its Istanbul bureau chief. She was speaking to me from the Tigrayan capital of Mekelle. Reuters News reports it has obtained audio from the Islamic State West African province in which the militant group said that the Boko Haram leader Abu Bakar Shekau was dead. VOA has not been able to verify the authenticity of the recording independently. The Nigerian military has been investigating Shekau's reported death since last month. U.S. officials have been cautious about declaring the Boko Haram leader dead, as there have been numerous unfounded previous reports of his demise. Over the weekend, local media reported that at least 20 people had been killed by junta forces in Myanmar's Ayarwadi River Delta region. It's the deadliest clash since April, when Myanmar security forces were accused of killing more than 80 people in Bago City. Earlier, I spoke with reporter Cape Diamond in Yangon about the attack.
What I can tell is that, what we knew is there was the explosion happened in that village early in the morning, and then the SAC, the military troops came in, and like they were trying to launch the operation against the villagers, and the villagers fled. Of course, they used the heavy weapons. They used a live round, but at the same time, the people that did not really have the weapons, but of course they have their handmade guns, like air gun, whatever. And at the same time, many people say that it was the people defend force in that area, but at the same time we knew that according to our sources, they were just the villagers from that village. But and also we were told that not only one village but also at least three village, the villagers fled the villages, and they spent a night in the jungle nearby. But we were told that many of them already came back to their original villages today.
Cape, I also wanted to ask you about what is known about the whereabouts of ousted de facto leader Aung San Suu Kyi. Over the weekend, it was reported that her lawyers do not know her exact location, and I understand you recently had the opportunity to speak with some of her legal counsel.
Of course, during the recent trial, they had a chance to meet with her privately for the first time, for mm-hmm. 30 minutes. By the time they were told that, they were told by the Aung San Suu Kyi that, last night that she was moved to another place, but she did not have any idea where it was, and also she did not really tell them where it was, So since then, they have no update where she is. But at the same time, the lawyer, he said that, okay, it might be the procedure. Sometime, the officials and the authorities, they move the defendant or the detainees to the place where it is close to the court, right? So it also might be the case that they move her to the place temporarily than where it is close to the court, right? But since then, they have no update where she is.
So it is possible that the court would move a defendant to another location. But why haven't they been able to get a straight answer from either the court, the police, or other government officials as to the exact location of Aung San Suu Kyi? What's their rationale of preventing the lawyers to know the exact whereabouts of their client?
Yeah, the thing is, there is the problem, the communication problem between the lawyers and the authorities. I mean, the police, because of course, it was the first time, in 3 months, 4 months, she had a chance to meet with her legal team privately for the instruction. According to the lawyer, it was a really quick, private meeting. They didn't have really, they didn't have any time to talk about other things. So since you know, they representing Aung San Suu Kyi, they have been asking for the meetings, you know, but they never have a chance. And they were always, they always got the reply that, you know, oh, the police are working on it. And also this time, you know, there is another court hearing, court trial will be on 7. So they also asked for the private meeting again, you know, on the day, but they still have not got any reply and the confirmation that, you know, they will have a chance to meet with her privately on that day, you know. And the lawyer said that, oh, you know, all they know right now is, of course, they have to be at the court by 10 a.m.
Reporter Cape Diamond was speaking to me from Yangon, Myanmar. You're listening to VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller. Pope Francis said on Sunday that he was pained by the discovery of the remains of 215 children a former Catholic school for Indigenous students in Canada. But he stopped short of an apology some Canadians are demanding. Reuters' Lucy Fielder takes it from here.
Canadian Prime Minister Justin Trudeau said this week the Catholic Church must take responsibility for its role in running many of the schools. Francis urged Canadian political and Catholic religious leaders to cooperate with determination, to shed light on the finding, and to seek reconciliation and healing. And he prayed for Canada's Indigenous families. The residential schools operated between 1831 and 1996 and were run on behalf of the government, mostly by the Catholic Church. The schools forcibly separated about 150,000 children from their homes. Many were subjected to abuse, rape, and malnutrition in what the Truth and Reconciliation Commission in 2015 called cultural genocide. The discovery last month of the remains of the children at the Kamloops Indian Residential School in British Columbia, which closed in 1978, has reopened wounds for survivors of the system. Francis has in the past apologized for the church's role in colonialism in the Americas, but he has mostly chosen to make direct apologies while visiting countries and talking to native peoples. And no papal visit to Canada is scheduled.
Lucy Fielder reports for Reuters News. British Prime Minister Boris Johnson will use the Group of Seven summit next week to urge world leaders to commit to vaccinating the global population by the end of 2022. Associated Press correspondent Zaria Shackley is up next.
Johnson is expected to stress the importance of a global vaccination drive when he meets with fellow world leaders on Friday in Cornwall on the coast of southwestern England for the first face-to-face G summit since the pandemic hit. President Joe Biden and leaders of Canada, France, Italy and Japan will arrive in Cornwall from Friday for 3 days of talks focusing on the global recovery from the pandemic. Britain's government pledged in February to give most of the country's surplus vaccine supply to COVAX, the United Nations-backed program aiming to supply poorer countries with jabs. Sarah Shackley, London.
World Food Safety Day is Monday, and United Nations agencies are calling for concerted action to ensure food is free of the toxins that every year cause the deaths of hundreds of thousands of people. Lisa Schlein has that story.
A UN report on global food security finds nearly 690 million people suffered from chronic hunger in 2019, before COVID-19. The full impact of the pandemic and food insecurity is not yet known. However, the report estimates as many as 132 million more people will have been short of food in 2020 because of COVID-19 lockdowns. Dominique Bourgeon is director of the Food and Agriculture Organization office in Geneva. He says food safety is key to food security.
Every year, 600 million people fall ill, one in 10. About, and 420,000 die from eating food contaminated with bacteria, viruses, parasites, toxins, or chemicals. Yet, this is the tip of the iceberg, as comprehensive surveillance data for foodborne illnesses is not available everywhere.
Moreover, he says unsafe food causes significant financial burdens in low and middle income countries, amounting to productivity losses of some $90 billion a year. UN agencies say food safety is a shared responsibility and everyone has a role to play in keeping food safe and keeping people healthy. Bourgeon says this includes those who produce the food, industry, governments, and consumers.
The way you store your food, the way you cook it, but of course it goes, I would say, from farm to fork. So really at the beginning of the process, the way food is being produced, the type of way the food is stored, and then the way it's transported, processed, etc.
UN agencies say food safety involves a holistic approach that considers human, animal, plant, and environmental health. Understanding and keeping all aspects of the food chain safe, they say, will contribute to a healthy life and a healthy planet. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
On Monday, female Cameroonian activists and opposition members will appeal to the United Nations Security Council to discuss possible solutions to escalating Boko Haram terrorism and the separatist crisis in the Central African state. They are also asking the United Nations to force Cameroon to respect human rights, release political prisoners, and negotiate a ceasefire with armed groups. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports that the government has refused thus far to respond to their appeal.
20 female leaders say in a letter to the United Nations Security Council that Cameroon, once the bastion of stability in Central Africa, is today conflict-ridden and on the brink of catastrophe. They say that more than 10,000 Cameroonians have died in the Boko Haram conflict on Cameroon's northern border with Nigeria and the separatist crisis in the Central African state's English-speaking western regions. They accuse Cameroon's government and rebels of gross human rights violations. Edith Kawala is the president of the Cameroon People's Party and founding member of Stand Up for Cameroon, which advocates for a peaceful transition to rebuild Cameroon. She says the women want the Security Council to include Cameroon on their agenda.
We want the UN to give us help now. We don't want them to wait till the situation is so bad and then to start telling us that they are bringing UN soldiers here. We want them to act now. Our population is dying. Over 1 million children are out of school. We cannot sit by as our country falls apart. There is no peace without respect of human rights, without justice.
Wala said the women want the UN to require Cameroon to respect human rights and release all non-violent political prisoners linked to Boko Haram, separatists, and the political crisis in the Central African state. The women say that for the sake of peace, UN member states should ask Cameroon to allow free public discussions on political transition. Cameroon's 88-year-old president, Paul Biya, has been in power for close to 40 years and is accused of wanting to hang on to power until he dies. Ejani Leonard Kulu is a Cameroonian political analyst at the UN University for Peace in Addis Ababa. He says it is very unlikely that the United Nations will take up the female leaders' proposals. He says the United Nations has already helped Cameroon, Chad, Nigeria, Niger, and Benin contribute troops to a joint task force to fight Boko Haram.
The UN is a partner in managing the crisis in Cameroon. If we should take Boko Haram, remember the multinational joint task force. It is financed and supported by the UN. The crisis in Northwest and Southwest, the UN has pronounced itself on several occasions that is an internal problem which Cameroon alone can solve.
Kulu said Cameroon female leaders should have carried out advocacy with the five permanent members of the Security Council, China, France, Russia, the United Kingdom, and the United States to ensure discussion of Cameroon at the Security Council. In another letter, the female leaders ask International Monetary Fund Managing Director Kristalina Georgieva to stop disbursing funds until the Cameroon government shows proof of transparent management. Tumaino Namjoya is mayor of the western town of Fumban, an official of the Cameroon Democratic Union and a former lawmaker in Cameroon's National Assembly.
Nous avons concomitamment saisi le FMI, Fonds Monétaire International, par rapport au financement.
Njoya says the female leaders are not indifferent to the high wave of corruption and theft of public funds in Cameroon. She says many government ministers have been asked to explain what happened to a $335 million IMF loan intended to stop the spread of COVID-19. She says it would be unfair to continue to give loans to Cameroon when the government has not accounted for amounts already received. Cameroon government spokesperson René Emmanuel Sadi did not respond when contacted by VOA about Njoya's comments. In a release read on state radio, Cameroon promised to investigate corruption and punish those found guilty. Cameroon, a majority French-speaking country, is facing several problems, including a separatist crisis in its English-speaking western regions and Boko Haram terrorism on its northern border with Nigeria. Cameroon also suffers the spillover of the crisis in the Central African Republic, with attacks by rebels on its eastern border and political tensions from Biya's long stay in power. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
The Israeli Prime Minister has railed against a proposed coalition government to unseat him a day after the nation's domestic security chief warned of the threat of political violence. Zachary Goldman from Reuters reports.
On the verge of losing his record-long grip on power, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu on Sunday lashed out at his perceived political opponents.
We are witnessing the greatest election fraud in the history of the country. In my opinion, in the history of any democracy.
His language reminiscent of another world leader who recently faced the prospect of losing power.
We had an election that was stolen from us.
It mirrors the rhetoric of former U.S. President Donald Trump, who falsely claims that his 2020 election defeat was the result of fraud.
This was a fraudulent election.
Those claims sparked a deadly assault by Trump supporters who stormed the U.S. Capitol to try to stop Congress from certifying his election loss. And now fears of political violence are bubbling up in Israel. Netanyahu's claims of fraud come just a day after Israel's chief of domestic security issued a rare warning of possible political violence in that country. Shin Bet director Nadav Argamon called on political and religious leaders to tone down potential incitement. Netanyahu is facing the prospect of an end to his 12-year run as premier after Israel's opposition leader Yair Lapid announced last week that he had succeeded in forming a governing coalition. The centrist cobbled together an unwieldy array of factions stretching from ultranationalist to leftist and even, for the first time in Israel's history, an Arab Islamist party. But Lapid's proposed government has yet to be sworn in and could still unravel before it begins. It will require a simple majority vote in the 120-member Knesset, but that could be more than a week away. Netanyahu has been whipping up outrage at the man expected to replace him as prime minister, Naftali Bennett. Bennett leads an ultra-nationalist party, and he broke his campaign pledge not to join a coalition with Lapid and left-wing and Arab parties. Netanyahu called on Bennett's party members to reject what he's called, quote, a dangerous leftist government.
Reuters reporter Zachary Goldman.
This is Science in a Minute.
Most people look at the availability of new COVID-19 vaccines as a sign that an end to the devastating pandemic may be in sight. According to various reports from the medical community, for some people with weak immune systems, these COVID-19 vaccinations may only be somewhat effective or even not effective at all. A new University of Michigan Medical School study shows that 3% of U.S. health-insured adults are taking drugs that can weaken their immune systems. The study suggests if infected with with the virus that causes COVID-19, those taking these immunosuppressant drugs may be at a higher risk for serious symptoms and being hospitalized for the illness. Dr. Beth Wallace, lead study author, says that it's being realized that people taking immunosuppressive drugs may have a slower and weaker response to COVID vaccines and that some might not respond at all. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Australian scientists are leading an international consortium that is building one of the world's most powerful ground-based telescopes. Phil Mercer reports that it promises to see further and clearer than the Hubble Space Telescope and unlock mysteries of the early universe.
The telescope is called MAVIS, or Multi-Conjugate Adaptive Optics Assisted Visible Imager and Spectrograph. It's a long name for a highly complex instrument that will be the first of its kind. It aims to remove blurring from conventional telescope images caused by turbulence in Earth's atmosphere, which is why the stars appear to twinkle in the night sky. Scientists in Australia say the new technology will allow them to peer back into the early universe and help them explore how the first stars formed 13 billion years ago, as well as monitoring changes in the weather on planets and moons in our solar system. Images produced by MAVIS will be three times sharper than the Hubble Space Telescope that was launched into Earth's low orbit in 1990 and remains in operation. Associate Professor Richard McDermid, a scientist based at Sydney's Macquarie University, says the new telescope will change the way we explore space.
The clarity gives us two things. It helps us see a sharper image, but it also helps us gain in sensitivity so we can see fainter things and we can see them more clearly. That allows us to push into a new frontier of the furthest and faintest things we can see. So, for example, the first stars in formation inside the first galaxies, because when we look far away in astronomy, we're also looking far back in time because it takes time for the light to reach us. And so, yeah, we're really building on the legacy of Hubble, but we are going to go deeper and even sharper.
The ground-based telescope will be installed at a facility in Chile, run by the European Southern Observatory, a research organization based in Germany. It will take 7 years to build at a cost of $44 million. The MAVIS consortium is led by the Australian National University and involves Macquarie University, Italy's National Institute for Astrophysics, and France's Laboratoire d'Astrophysique. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
And finally, June 6 marked the 77th anniversary of D-Day, when Allied forces stormed the beaches of France's Normandy region. Historians say the months-long battles that followed liberated Europe from Nazi Germany and gave the Allies the upper hand in World War II. VOA's Arash Arabasadi reports how survivors marked the day.
They call our beach Omaha. Don't ask me why. I've never been to Omaha, the one in Nebraska, I mean. It's anything like Omaha, France, you can have it.
June 6, 1944, D-Day. More than 150,000 American, British, and Canadian forces stormed the beaches of France's Normandy region, launching months of bloody battle. Experts say the assault changed the balance of power in World War II. Sunday, some 77 years later, some veterans marked the occasion publicly, even as ongoing coronavirus pandemic travel restrictions kept others, along with the families of fallen soldiers, from attending. In the English village of Alrus, a group of Normandy veterans and relatives gathered at the unveiling of a D-Day monument called Vers-sur-Mer. D-Day veteran Sergeant Bernard Morgan remembers the invasion.
The thing I remember most is the sad sight of seeing so many dead bodies on the beach. They were mostly soldiers who landed early in the morning. Their landing craft had stopped short and they jumped into the water. Unfortunately, a lot of them were drowned because the kit they were carrying was so heavy and the poor lads had no chance. And it was the first dead body I'd seen, and it was very upsetting.
Morgan says he lost three men in Normandy, and wearing his medals, especially on the anniversary, reminds him of his fallen soldiers. Coronavirus restrictions limited the size of the crowd in Aarhus, but more than 100 veterans remotely watched the event, paying tribute to the more than 4,400 Allied troops who lost their lives on D-Day. Arash Arabasadi, VOA News.
And that'll do it for us. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our entire production team, thank you very much for listening. Be sure to stay up to date with world news and events 24 hours a day. You can do so by pointing your web browser to voanews.com. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Be well, be safe, and have a great day.